Hampshire Gaming Regulatory Oversight Authority meeting, continuing meetings on statutory mandate we've given. And for this meeting, we have an agenda that starts with a presentation by Representative David Hess, who was unable to be at our earlier public hearing and asked at that time allow us to come in at a later time to present his views. Of course, that is most welcome given his engagement in this issue over the years. And then we're going to move on from that to a presentation we're very fortunate to have with us, Kenneth McCabe, who has lengthy experience with and deep experience with Pennsylvania's gaming system. And we'll move on after that to talk about fiscal and capacity issues with White Sands gaming consultant Jim Nickerson, who's here with us. And then we'll have some time at the end to talk about looking forward, where we're going to try to go with all of this to reach a conclusion by our deadline of December 15th. So why don't we just move right into Representative Hess. You have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Hess. I live at the Merrimack Act 24, which most of you know is what's it. I am here to address one of the charge, specific charge that you have given by statutory authority out of HB2. On the best of authority, I understand that the entire commission is literate, so I'm not going to read my prepared statement. I assume you can do that if it's easier later on in the process. I would like to...
I just want to interrupt you for one sec. I forgot to say one thing. I believe all members of the authority are here, save Kathleen Sullivan, who had notified me that an urgent matter had come up and she's unable to be here today. So we have 8 of 9 members here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Again, and thank you for indulging me. I had previous commitments, both in state and out of state, during the public hearing in September and your last meeting. I couldn't make you the one. I'm not going to go over this in detail. What I have noticed is that from the newspaper reports of your previous meetings, that what I have to say here this morning is probably repetitive of what you have heard from a number of other sources. Let me preface my remarks by saying, as the chairman has indicated, I've been involved in the debate on expanded gambling, specifically on casino gambling, for well over 20 years. As an assistant attorney general under Warren Ludman back in the 70s, I was charged with investigating a potential licensee for the racetrack up in Belmont. As a result of that investigation, the attorney general ruled that the licensee was not qualified to run the racetrack with its affiliated gambling. That resulted in a lawsuit in federal court where both Warren and I were personally charged by the potential licensee. That case was dismissed, but that was the genesis of my initial involvement in gambling and expanded gambling in New Hampshire. I believe that file is still sealed, although I would defer to the Attorney General on that subject. With respect to a regulatory structure for expanded gambling, I'm going to focus in on casino gambling as the method of expanded gambling, because that has consistently been the vehicle that has been advocated in legislation almost annually. I strongly believe that we need to create a new, vigorous, and robust regulatory structure in order to address that form of expanded gambling. I say this not because I have nothing but the highest respect for commissioners of the Racing and Charitable Gaming Commission or the commissioners on the Lottery Commission, not only those currently sitting, but those sitting in the past. Unfortunately, both of those commissions are basically citizen volunteer part-time commissions. And if we are going to expand gambling, which I hope we won't, but if we are, I think we need a full-time agency that is experienced and expert on the subject. That is why in this memorandum and in earlier documentation, which I believe, Mr. Chairman, you are aware of, which I submitted to members of the Regulatory Subcommittee of the so-called Super Committee before, just before our executive session last year. Most of these points are contained in that memorandum. I think not only do we need a new full-time authority to oversee expanded gambling, and perhaps all gambling, I'm not commenting on that, but I also think we need to put into place a serious system of checks and balances, dividing the responsibilities of different functions in this authority so that they aren't concentrated in either one person or in one small group of people. I have outlined in this memorandum my thoughts about how it might be the best way to do it. And to a large extent, it's patterned after the Massachusetts law that was recently adopted, and also patterned after other states, although I won't go into that in detail. Basically, I think the authority, whoever are the members, and in HB 678, I think it is, Representative Valancourt suggested it be the Commissioner of Safety, the Commissioner of Dread, and the Commissioner of Revenue, I think, or Department of Administration. I think the authority should have responsibility for a limited number of functions. They should have responsibility for setting up the structure. They should have responsibility for adopting the rules that the authority will adopt to implement expanded gambling, and then they will have the what I call the adjudicatory responsibility to sit as a quasi-judicial body over any making decisions with respect to licensing, both licensing of the major parties as well as the equipment providers, and also to sit on any administrative or quasi-criminal proceedings for alleged violations of the rules. They would be responsible for those functions. And in that sense, they would be an entity that oversees the operation. I would vest the investigatory and enforcement powers, again, modeling it after the Commonwealth of Massachusetts legislation, I would vest that in a new division of the Attorney General's office, totally separate and distinct from the authority. A division that would not report to this new gaming authority, but would operate independently of it. And I would provide that any enforcement personnel that deal with enforcing, ensuring that the rules and statutes of expanded gaming are complied with, report directly to the Attorney General's office, and that they be responsible for enforcement, so that if they bring an enforcement action, it would be to an authority that they are not subordinate to. They are independent of. Thirdly, I think the Lottery Commission has tremendous expertise in the computerization and organization of numerous locations for gambling, for lottery tickets in this instance. That expertise can be utilized and exploited so that the Lottery Commission or members of that commission can, in effect, set up the electronic or the mechanism that is needed to operate these games of chance effectively, efficiently, and provide a background for it. So again, in that way, you would have at least three different places within state government where involvement in expanded gambling occurs. And the reason I'm concerned about checks and balances is because if we get one casino in this state, it will dwarf every other enterprise in this state in terms of cash flow and as a taxpayer to the state. If you do a simple reverse math, you take the numbers that Millennium has given us for what the state is likely to receive as revenue from gambling, let's call it $140 million, $150 million, whatever, $170 million, that, we are told, is one-third of the net proceeds, 30% of the net proceeds. If you back that out, you find out that the net revenue total that they expect to generate from one casino of the size that you're talking about is on the order of $500 million. If that represents 10% of the total amount of money gambled, you're talking about a cash flow of $5 billion going through one casino in 1 year. That's more than twice the size of the general fund here in New Hampshire that we collect and dispense. So the amount of money involved in this thing. While it occurs quickly and it may be used through cards, et cetera, the amount of money that we're talking about has the potential for significant and for possibly undue political influence. And I think the way to minimize the risk of that occurring is for a system of checks and balances and a division of responsibility and authority. The second thing I would urge the Commission to do, seriously consider, is to require that all of the rules and regulations governing expanded gambling be vetted and be adopted before any process starts for licensing or for anything to actually accomplish it. We have historically in our bills always had a parallel track because there was this rush to get the cash flow into the state as soon as possible, hopefully in the fiscal year following the year in which we were asked to vote on this. Consequently, every bill that I can recall, no, that's not true. Almost all the bills that I can recall in the last decade have provided for temporary rules and regulations to be adopted, preliminary rules and regulations, while the RFP process was ongoing. That has a lot of negatives, in my opinion, not the least of which is the fact that under RSA 541A, our administrative rule statute, preliminary rules do not require public hearing. If we adopt permanent rules first, we will have the regulatory structure in place, up and running and functioning before you even start the process of expanded gambling. I think that's critical. I think we should follow the statutory provisions at a very minimum. I would personally like to see for an enterprise of this nature, this large, potentially affecting the state, to have at least have more than one public hearing in the process. I throw that out for your consideration. One of the things that you have heard in your earlier hearings, and you're not alone, we hear it in the House and in the Senate all the time, is that some state agencies are starving from funds. They are understaffed. They are overworked because they don't get the amount of support they need because we have competing budgetary considerations in the state, and we in the political branches of government tend to put money other places and not necessarily where some of the regulatory people think they need the money. I think you heard the executive director of the Racing and Charitable observe that problem in his organization, I think, was the first hearing. What I would suggest you consider is to dedicate the first amount of funds that would come to the state from expanded gambling specifically to the regulatory, administrative, and enforcement function. I have in this memo suggested that the first 5% of all net revenues from expanded gambling go specifically to the regulatory enforcement and administrative agencies that would oversee expanded gambling. That, I think, is one way to address the issue about what happens when competing agencies buy for the same dollars and sometimes the regulatory function gets dropped by the wayside. One prime example of that that has not been before this commission, to my knowledge, is the tobacco settlement situation. It's my recollection that a number of ways and means that as part of the tobacco settlement and because of a underfunding, if you will, or understaffing, some very important things slipped through the boards, the cracks on that issue. And that's something on this subject we can't afford to happen. We simply cannot afford to have a weak, ineffective regulatory structure in place. Finally, I would suggest with respect to the process of licensing that process be a full adjudicatory process. All of the bills that I remember looking at over the last decade or more have a very streamlined process which basically says the authority has the power to decide who gets the license, and basically that's it. While this is a slight exaggeration, the bills that we have seen over the past year basically make that decision irrevocable and not appealable. They also streamlined the hearing process to preclude different competing license applicants from cross-examining each other, presenting rebuttal testimony, etc. I think, again, because of the significance in size and the potential impact to the state, that the hearing process for such licenses should be fully open and adjudicatory, with the rights of competing entities to cross-examine, to present rebuttal information, and to file an appeal into the judicial process, a meaningful appeal. I'm going to leave my comments at that, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. I thank you for indulging me and allowing me to hear.
We thank you, too. And time is short. Many good recommendations, by the way. I would invite questions just for a few minutes. I think we wanted to limit the time of this presentation because we need to go on to the other presentations, and we're already beyond the time that I had thought we could allow. But we can go, three or four more minutes for questions. So, Senator?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative. Your expansion of gaming, that we need all these additional revenues. Well, basically, in the state of New Hampshire, the expansion of gaming really is a video lottery machine, which is a computer. In our charitable gaming, we have every table game available throughout the state already. And yet, the experts have testified that the video lottery machine is the simplest to regulate because it's a computer. It's the table games that are problematic. And yet, in this legislative body, there has been no push for these type of regulations to control the charitable end, which now, by expert testimony, is really where the problem children can reside, so to speak. Including representatives came into the Senate last year to Ways and Means requesting an increase in the bet of the table games, even though they had opposed Senate Bill 152, which added additional. So my question to you is, as a proponent for regulation, which I absolutely agree, I think we have to make sure that our citizens are protected, but why now this huge push for video, which is the easiest to regulate, when you have never done that with the table game on the charitable side?
Well, speaking personally, I have opposed every increase in charitable gaming that has come across my committees in the last 20 years. I think it is a horrible development in the state. I think it is underregulated, not because the regulators are lax, but because they have not been given the resources, the manpower, and the salary to do it. I was opposed to any raise in the stakes of the bet. I was opposed to the actually expanding the Monte Carlo nights beyond the one night a year of local venues in the town hall where the men's club or the women's club got together and did that. I prosecuted violations of Lucky Sevens back in the 70s when it was a very simple mechanical process of handing out Lucky Seven tickets from machines. We had problems back then. I prosecuted them as a member of the Attorney General's office. So while I cannot tell you, I cannot explain why a majority of my fellow House members have thought it great to expand charitable gaming, both in terms of the amount bettable, as well as the games that were capable of being played, as well as the number of times that they were being played, as well as setting up a structure which would allow permanent gaming establishments in about, seven or eight places around the state. I personally was firmly against that, and I remain firmly against that.
So these regulations, you would support the umbrella to cover everything?
I have not given that much thought, but certainly if you have a regulatory structure in place that's going to be overseeing table games in full commercial casinos that will rake in tens of, if not hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of the year, that regulatory structure should be readily available to govern charitable gaming. Although, personally, my opinion, once a commercial casino comes in with unlimited gaming bets, charitable gambling is...
Other questions?
It's going to revert back to what it was 20 years ago.
I guess we're all set.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll turn to Kenneth McKay, who's going to talk with us about Pennsylvania's gaming regulatory system. We're really grateful that you're here. Rather than my attempting to introduce you, maybe you can say a few words about your background and then tell us, sort of starting with the overview of the structure, what you think might be most helpful to us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I appreciate the invite to come to you today to kind of pay back and pay forward what the courtesy that was put out to us when we first started gaming in Pennsylvania. What I would like to do is I'm here for you to answer your questions based on our experiences and in Pennsylvania. What I'd like to do is just quickly introduce myself and then get into the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, how it was established, and how we have progressed to become the number two gaming jurisdiction in the United States, surpassing New Jersey. A little bit of background about myself. I was the one of the original and longest serving commissioner on the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board. I spent 6.5 years on the board as one of the original commissioners, and I retired from that in 2011 because we were term limited. We were limited to only 6 years max on the board, and I was able to do 6.5. Prior to being a commissioner, I was a senior executive in the FBI. I spent 21 years almost in the FBI. As I say, in 30 years in the government, I moved 14 times. Whereas a senior executive in the FBI, retired as the special agent in charge of Western Pennsylvania and West Virginia, all FBI operations, investigations in those jurisdictions. You may have seen me on TV a few times for the pizza bomber case, sniper case that we had while I was there. Prior to that, I was for 8 years, 8 months, and 5 days, I was an officer of the United States Marine Corps and proudly served the country. As one of the original commissioners, I take pride in what we accomplished. In the 6.5 years that we were there, we started a new government agency from scratch. Created over 15,000 jobs, with 93% of them going to Pennsylvanians and requiring that of the casinos, and generating over $5.1 billion in revenue for the state of Pennsylvania while I was there. And they're continuing to do well today. The law was initially passed in the early morning hours of July 4th, 2004. The law was originally called the Pennsylvania Racehorse Development and Gaming Act. One of the points I want to get across to you is that no matter what you do, you're going to be criticized. No matter what decisions you make, people are going to think that the fix is in, that the reason the person got this license was because he was friends of the governor. He was friends of so-and-so. He had political contributions. He's a minority, or it was a she. We heard that all the time. Be prepared to be sued. We were sued, I can't tell you how many times we were sued based on all our decisions. We were sued to not even legalize gaming. We were, in fact, by legislation, and then by court ruling, the Supreme Court ruling in Pennsylvania, determined to be quasi-judicial, quasi-judicial role when we made our decisions, which protected us. And in fact, Donald Trump sued us, I think, 3-4 different times, and the last time tried to sue us not only in our capacity as board members, but individually for $20 million each. And having been a government employee for 30 years, I did not have $20 million to give them. And you talked about being scared. You know, when I got sued in the FBI, I knew I had the Department of Justice and the U.S. government at that time behind me. Now, I don't know if the U.S. government would be behind us, but I did not have $20 million. When I was appointed by the President Pro Tem of the Senate, a Republican, and maybe I should go into a little bit first of the makeup of the board. There were seven commissioners. We were appointed by the Senate, the House, and the governor. The Senate had two appointees, one for the majority party, one for the minority. The President Pro Tem had one, the minority Senate leader had appointment. In the House, the Speaker had one appointment, and then the minority leader had one appointment, and then the governor had three appointments. The three, out of one of the three governor's appointees, had to be the chairman of the board. Now, because Pennsylvania is the way it is and was, nobody trusted each other. So what they, part of the legislation, called for was a qualified majority that for anything to be passed, that for any license to be issued, the four legislative appointees had to agree upon it, and one of the governor's appointees had to agree upon it. So we actually had the power of veto if I wanted to stop anything or didn't think anything was right. And I did use that. And it slowed everything up for 6 months because I wouldn't budge from what they were trying to do because I didn't like it. I thought it was paid political payback to people. And I actually ended up winning where they agreed the person that was proposing something withdrew it and said, okay, I give up. We'll let the free market determine. It had to do with suppliers. My appointee was a Senate Republican President Pro Tem. He was against gambling, and as was the Republican caucus. When he appointed me, I had to go through an interview process. I had no idea that he was even looking at me. When I got called in, I was still the head of the FBI in Western Pennsylvania. I thought I was being called in to help set up the Bureau of Investigation, the investigative. And as they're interviewing me, I'm like, well, wait a minute, you're talking about as a commissioner's position. Not, I'm prepared to talk about how I was going to establish the Bureau of Investigations, how we were going to do background checks, how we were going to do some of the things that the representative just said with the checks and balances to make sure that this is kept legal and above board. Because I knew gambling from the organized crime side. I had been in the organized crime section at FBI headquarters. I'm not going to say I had the pleasure, but I knew Henry Hill. One of my good friends was the handler. If you don't know Henry, who Henry Hill is, he was the mob wannabe that they made the movie Goodfellas over. One of my colleagues' friends was his handler. So I got to meet him and talk to him and get into his head. And then Michael Francis, another Colombo family captain who has supposedly left the mob, he's on TV, to hear how a capo actually thinks about gaming. And learning from there, and I went up with my boss to the Senate, the U.S. Senate Committee on Organized Crime to talk about, and with him behind the screen and everything, was the Russian gasoline tax scheme that they were perpetrating. So my experience with gaming was also being taught at the FBI Academy how to cheat. How the cheaters cheat on the gaming. So, you know, I came in with a jaundiced eye, and when my appointee, who was against gaming, appointed me, he said, look, Kenny, we're against gaming, but the people have spoken. The law is passed. The law is the law. We're not going to be obstructionists. I don't want you to be an obstructionist. What I want you to do was to protect the people of Pennsylvania and to keep this open and honest. That was my mandate. That was the guidance I had to go forward. And that's how I went about my job. One of the things
I may interrupt. Were you appointed then as a full-time commissioner?
Oh, okay. Yes, we were full-time commissioners. It was a full-time appointment. The initial appointments for the four legislative appointees was 2 years to then be able to be reappointed for 2 years, another 2 years for a maximum of 6 years. The governor's appointees were, one appointee had a 1-year term to be able to be reappointed for 3 years, another, his second appointee had a 2-year term to be reappointed for 3 years, and then his third appointee had a term of 3 years to be able to be reappointed for 3 years. We were full time, the people that were appointed, I found, because I did backgrounds on all of them on my own. Okay, who am I dealing with here? The FBI agent in me is, who can I trust? It? And of course, none of them trusted me when I came here. I was not a political person. They could not believe that I had never even met my appointee until he interviewed me. He called me. He said, "Come on, you had to know." I said, "Look, no, I'm never. As being a Marine officer and then FBI, we try. Whoever the boss is, the boss. He's the president. Okay, yes, sir. We'll, two bags full. We'll go out and do what we have to do." So they couldn't believe me, and they didn't trust me. And of course, I was looking at them. But they were leaders in the business world of Pennsylvania. CEO of one of the biggest law firms. CEO of Temple Health. A former legislature, CEO of a health company, former NFL referee, assistant director of admissions for Carnegie Mellon University, were some of the people there. And one of the things that they did, and I don't know if this may help you, was our salary. They knew that to get these people to come on the board, they had to offer us a good salary, good full-time salary. And we did. It was public knowledge. We were making $145,000 a year as commissioners. We were appointed. We were all sworn in. We had to leave our other jobs. We weren't able to do both. I had to retire from the FBI because one of the FBI also wouldn't let me do both. And we did it full time. After we got sworn in, we had no place to go. We looked at each other and where do we go? They just had this big ceremony. We just got sworn in. Now what do we do? We don't know. Well, we went and found a table someplace and said, okay, how are we going to do this? How are we going to set up this organization? The organization was intended to be independent of all other government agencies and political influence within the state. We had a racehorse commission. In fact, we had two. There was the Harness Racing Commission and then the Thoroughbred Racing Commission. They were independent of us. And that's going to become significant when I tell you about the different license. We had the Lottery Commission that was under the Secretary of Revenue. He was given the task of helping us get started, and he loaned us people that we were then able to, they were able to go out and find us a building and do some of the ant work to help us get started. The downside to that is we started, these people are good, he's giving us. We hired them away at a higher salary than they were making with the Secretary of Revenue. And he said, wait a minute. Now, we had also had part of this board three political ex officio officers, the Treasurer, the Secretary of Revenue, and the Secretary of Agriculture, were non-voting ex officio members of the board. We started this government agency. We went, from nothing to, when I left, I think there was 237 people.
And just to interrupt, you had no relationship once you got off the ground with lottery?
No relationship at all with the lottery. What they had written in the law, the legislators wrote into the law, that there will be lottery machines placed at the casinos. And that was the only interaction. When the casinos opened, there were the lottery machines there. The lottery sent a couple of people for PR, pretty girls that stood there and handed out, lotto information. Here's the lottery tickets. And there was a lot of debate, I know, of, okay, are ticket sales going to go down? Is gambling going to take money away from the lottery? And I think the statistics show, the numbers show they really didn't. The numbers didn't go down. The lottery wasn't negatively affected. That's another point that I want to digress to. Is there's a lot of rumors, a lot of stories out there, a lot of misunderstanding of what gaming is really like today. And I had that when I went in. My mother still has that. When I went there, Marine, FBI, are you sure you're going to do this? I said, Mom, I wouldn't do it if it wasn't above board, legit. We're New Yorkers, and they grew up in Brooklyn, and I knew some of the mob guys that were involved in this stuff. You're sure? Yeah, Mom, okay. Gambling, the gaming industry wants to be regulated. The casinos are just another portfolio. What I've learned is casinos are another asset in a portfolio of a lot of bigger companies or investment groups. They are located multi-jurisdictional. They're not just going to be in most of the casinos nowadays are not just in Pennsylvania. They may have a casino in Vegas. They may have one in New Jersey. They may have one in Michigan, Louisiana. And what the regulatory agencies have done is we all talk to each other. And that's why I said this is a little bit of payback. Because at the beginning, I went around with some of the other commissioners, and we went to all the different gaming boards, regulatory boards. How did you set things up? What did you do? What are the problems that you see, really? What keeps you busy every day? What keeps you busy at night? And we then picked and choose what we want. We had Las Vegas on one end of the spectrum that we felt was too easy, and we had New Jersey on another end that we thought was too strict, because when they first started, they were telling the casinos, the hotel, what color carpet to put in, what color tile to put in. We said, well, that's a little bit ridiculous. We wanted to go someplace in the middle, be an aggressive, tough, aggressive regulatory agency, but also the flexibility to be able to have them make money and to operate. And we knew, and our philosophy was, if they're a success, we're going to be a success. The people of Pennsylvania will benefit from what we do. And time has shown that that has happened. But go back to in all these different locations, if something happens in one jurisdiction that they get in trouble, all the other jurisdictions know about it. And they'll then start looking at their licensee there, and if we pulled a license in one jurisdiction, that affected them wherever they were. And we did pull one license before they even put a shovel in the ground. That was Foxwoods. And when we license people, and I'll go through that in a few minutes, the licensing process, we put conditions on it. If they didn't meet these conditions, we had the authority to pull the license. Foxwoods didn't make the conditions. We pulled their license, and the board currently is now, the application process has been reopened for the one remaining casino in Philadelphia, and it's being let in a competitive process. Let me move on to the number of casinos and the licensing and process. We had authorized by law 14 casinos for the state of Pennsylvania. And then from the 14 casinos, they were broken down into Category 1, Category 2, Category 3. Category 1, we got 7 licenses to issue on Category 1. Those 7 licenses were to go to the existing racetracks in Pennsylvania. The politics of the whole law was to help regenerate the racing industry in Pennsylvania. So the existing racetracks automatically would get, if qualified, a license. But they had to go through, and that was a non-competitive, they got it, but they had to go through the same background investigation, financial investigation, and licensing process that we required of everybody, which include public hearings, in-camera hearings, public input, where we had public talk about the racetrack or the casinos that were coming in. And honestly, we didn't license some of the people that the race commission had licensed. So it was contingent. If they had a license from the racing commission, and then while I was there, they combined the two, the harness and the race and the thoroughbred into one racing commission. And there's still one remaining racetrack license out there that has not applied. Once they get the license for the racetrack, they then are authorized to then apply for a license with the gaming board. And we have had a gaming board while I was there, and they still do a lot of problems with that last licensee to become qualified. Yeah, they had the license for the racehorse racetrack. But we told them, you're not going to qualify for a license. You don't have the financial backing. We don't like this person, this group that's involved with where the money's coming from, follow the money. We're never going to license you. So, you've got to get rid of them and find a different financing. And that license has changed hands a couple of times. So there were 7 racetrack licenses they won. We then had 5 Category 2 licenses. The Category 2 were considered what you would consider the Las Vegas license. Full only slots at the time, and that was what initially was approved, was slots. 3-4 years later, 2009, 2010, table games were legalized, and we implemented that, and we became full Las Vegas-style type of casinos, but not built on the grandiose of what you think of the Strip of Las Vegas. And that was another thing I learned, was the difference between these casinos. You had destination casinos, you had neighborhood casinos, you had racinos, and that's what we considered the seven racetracks, are racinos. Integrating, and part of what the requirement was to do is integrate the gaming floor with the racing, with the racetrack, to try to enhance the racing experience for people and get people back in there. The five standalone casinos, Category 2, was in a competitive process. We had a total of 23 applicants for these licenses. And like I said, you're going to be sued. Once we made decisions on where they were going to go, we were sued by all the looters. So that stopped and slowed the whole progress of building the casinos and generating revenue for the state of Pennsylvania. One of the things that the legislation did do was any lawsuit against us automatically was heard by the Supreme Court. So any state lawsuit automatically went to the Supreme Court, and then they would try to expedite it for us because it meant holding up revenue for the state of Pennsylvania. Like I said, not only did we get sued by the losers, but when we made our decision, that was when the time some also the fix was in. Even before we issued the license, the mayor of Pittsburgh came out and said the fix, publicly said the fix is in for the Pittsburgh casino. Newspaper. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Nobody's told me the fix is in, and I have the power of veto. Myself and two other commissioners, one other in Western PA, the former NFL referee, and he was also assistant commissioner director, director of admissions for Carnegie Mellon, and then the chairman met with the mayor in private. We went and said, look, and I took the lead because I haven't been the former FBI agent in charge of all that. I said, you know that the fix is in. First of all, I don't know it, and then Sanford spoke up. I don't know it. The chairman said, nobody's talked to me. But if you know, I have the U.S. Attorney's phone number right here in my phone. Come on. We'll call. I want an investigation right now. You know, somebody told you that the fix is in. I'm not going to be part of anything that, you know, is out there. This was in a newspaper. Again, it went back on us. So, you know, why even go through the process? Everybody knows it's going to go over there. Well, he backed off. No, well, you know, that land has been empty for 7 years over there. They've been talking since 1992 that's where the riverboats were going to go. Then when the riverboats didn't go, that's where the casino was going to go. And, of course, there was an applicant for that position there. And so I really don't know. Well, see, we want a public rebuttal, you know, take this away, take it back publicly, because you're putting a black mark on us. He did that. But fast forward, when we gave the license to Pittsburgh, we didn't give it to where everybody thought it was going to go. And a side story, like I said, I've got a very prominent person within Pittsburgh and international. If I said his name, you would all know him immediately, called me and said, what are you guys doing? I said, what do you mean, what are we doing? We've made the best decision based on our criteria, location, job creation, community impact, the community influence. But we were told it was going across the river because, you know, he wanted to buy some property over where this casino was going to go, and it was, you know, 50 cents on the dollar, you know, an acre before we put the casino. And once we made that, it was now $500 an acre. It was going to cost him more money, and he was quite upset. And I said, I'm sorry, but I know who told you that, but they weren't authorized, and they were wrong. And I'm sorry, but we did what was right. And then that's when, also, it was given to a minority. We were then accused that the only reason we gave it to him was because he was a minority. And I've had to defend this publicly in the newspaper, TV, and in grand jury to tell how this process worked. It was no. And, in fact, we talked about Pittsburgh first, and it was unanimous that we gave it to him. People could have criticized us if we issued all the other licenses, and this was the last one, and we hadn't given it to the minority yet, and, well, you know, okay, we got to, you know, they're pushing us to give this minority diversity. No, he was the first, Pittsburgh was the first one we talked to, and it was easy because he has the best product. He had the best casino.
Can you put your finger on what regulatory provisions sort of enabled you to have this integrity in your decision-making process? What enabled you to be so independent?
One was our personalities. We have some strong personalities, and our executive sessions got to be interesting sometime, arguing, headstrong, but we're also backed by the law. They wanted us to be independent. We had no ex officio contacts. If any politician, anybody tried to talk to us about one of these locations, we had to stop them, and we had to log it in. And that created a problem for some of my appointee at one time. I got a phone call about something from one of the staffers. You know, Senator so-and-so wouldn't be happy. I said, you've got to stop right now. I said, you know, I think this is, you're going down the wrong path, and I'm going to report it. And then at the meeting, I publicly announced it. And he went bouncing off the wall. I said, no, look, you're going to, you know, this is the rule. So we had the law to back us up, and our own personal integrity.
And the rest.
I'm wondering if what the chairman had asked, I think more specifically, would be, what were those criteria that gave you that independence to say that we follow all of our rules, and that's how come we were on this side of the river, not the other side, or this candidate? It seems to me that you set criteria that really delineated who you could pick and who you couldn't. It's the criteria that I wonder about.
Okay, I'll get to that, because that is important. Once I'll move on to then, after the five competitive casinos, we had two resorts casinos, and they were lesser. They had 500 slots, and they were supposed to be another amenity to the resort. And in actuality, what they came up with is, to get the law passed, they looked at the state and said, okay, we're going to put two in Philadelphia. By law, that's what was mandated, one in Pittsburgh, but the other three wherever we determined. But also, where we determined it to go, it went. The local municipality could not pass zoning laws or prevent the casino from being built there, which caused a lot of agita. Some local mayors, especially the mayor of Philadelphia, was not, we wanted to go downtown, and we were looking at three sites. Three of the candidates, applicants, had sites along the river, and that's where we ended up putting both of them, the Foxwoods and Sugar House. We wanted to put it down there, and they were up in arms.
I'm sorry.
So, excuse me.
I heard that as two resorts when you said, how many resorts were there?
In Pennsylvania?
Yeah. When you got to the siting of the resorts, you said two resorts, but then you said, as you were making your remarks to Senator Rausch, you said there was two in Philadelphia and others other places.
Confused. The law told us that two standalone casinos were going to go in Philadelphia, one in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
The two resorts, there were only two resorts in Pennsylvania the whole time. So what was happening was, they looked at the map and saw, okay, this is possible. How can we need the vote, and this is politics, and you're all familiar with politics. We need to get the vote from this section. How are we going to get it? Well, what do they have here? What are we going to give them? Well, they got a resort. Okay, let's give them a resort license. Okay, Senator so-and-so, Representative so-and-so, now I'll vote positive. Honestly, that's the way it went.
So there were a total of five resort licenses.
No,
but there were two
five standalone casinos, two resort.
Okay.
And then seven racetracks, casinos. So a total of 14.
So the resorts were ones that were already in place.
They had to be an existing resort.
They were like
the racetracks. Criteria. Not only the criteria, but the resorts had to have 270 hotel rooms. They had to have other amenities. Swimming pool, golf course, horseback riding, something like that. Yeah,
that's fine. I just was confused about the numbers and where they were.
I'm sorry.
I'm back on track. Thank you.
They had to be a certain mileage away from the racetracks were being protected. They had to be 30 miles from any possible racetrack, and then 20 miles from any other casino. The other things we took into consideration was their diversity plan, the economic impact, How many people are they going to hire? Their architectural plan. What are some of the others? I'm trying to think. Public input.
Traffic
studies. What they say they were going to generate. Two things I now want to take off of that thought is, one, we had these criteria, and we actually had books made up with each of the ones, okay, this is criteria, economic impact, community input, community impact, traffic, hire and diversity plan, a problem gaming plan. We made each of them have a problem gaming, how well that was planned, and then across we would have the different casino applicants, and we would rate them. One of the things that I found that I think it was a shortcoming in this is each one of us prioritized these requirements differently. So when I was considering maybe the Pittsburgh location, I put location as the number one priority, where one of my fellow commissioners may have put economic impact. Another one may have put community input. So the weight was different, and sometimes we would come up with, well, I think this is a better casino, and so, well, no, I think this because it's more of a better impact, economic impact. Yeah, but the location, look where this location is, tremendous. It's going to revitalize this whole south side. So that wasn't consistent amongst us of where we ranked the different casinos. The criteria. Oh, I forgot my thought was what the second one was. The second.
What about the importance of an advisor?
That was where I was going. That was where I was going with the second point. Is we had public hearings, and we gave every applicant the opportunity to appear before us, present their plan, present their numbers. The public also had their input. This was all public. It was a big to-do. One of the things that I found is for the applicant for the three Pittsburgh, I'm going to stick with the Pittsburgh ones because it's easier to say the whole state, is each applicant had their experts and said, okay, my casino is going to generate so much money per machine, which will equal out this much revenue per year, that the taxes will be this. And these two, this is their numbers, which are, of course, lower than mine. Well, the next applicant would come up with their expert. Our applicant, numbers are this. Their numbers are wrong. We will generate more revenue for the state, and these two are going to be less. Then the third one would come up, and, of course, it's like huff and puff your house down. But no, they're both wrong. Our numbers are the best. And we're like, whoa, who do we agree with? What do we look? So they had their experts. And we worked with the Innovation Group, Spectrum, White Sands, Price Waterhouse, and a number of other independent consultants, which has now become. What we did as a board, we hired PricewaterhouseCoopers and said, you are going to be our experts. We want you to go out, do your feasibility study on every casino applicant here. Not only the feasibility study, but the numbers, revenue. And some of the numbers were close, but they were ours. They were doing it for us. We had somebody representing us that we felt we could trust, maybe because we were paying for them. A lot of times the numbers were close. Okay, there's a 20, and PricewaterhouseCoopers has said, they maybe do their drive time analysis a little different. They're looking, okay, we didn't know that they were considering new machines or working. But there were a couple times that they were millions of dollars apart. And we had to take all that into consideration. You're going to have all these experts come in and tell you. I think you need to, we felt comfortable when we had somebody doing it for us.
So you must have had a pretty robust budget. Had a pretty robust budget even before the...
We started out with $7 million that we borrowed from the state. And then what happened was, as the casinos were up and running, we were able to do that for a couple years, because because our budget became like $35-34 million. But the casinos all paid for it. They were required by law to, and to keep it real simple, we had to keep that account up to a certain level. Once it started going down, we had a draw from each of the casinos. This is what you got to put in to keep this money funded.
Well, once they were licensed, they had to start paying in?
Yes. Yeah. And then they had to pay back the debt.
Which, $7 million.
Yes. Which became like $21 million. So we had hired our own expert to tell us the numbers. One of the other things that I learned and saw is we had a lot of public hearings, public input, pro and anti gaming. Not in my backyard, or totally against gaming. One of the things I learned is as these experts would speak before us, and they came from everything, and as the Attorney General knows and law enforcement knows, and the Commissioner of Safety, you can pretty much get an expert to say anything if you pay them the right price. I learned to first ask, okay, who's behind this study or this expert. If it was an anti-gaming person, I know his findings by the time he gets around to them is going to be negative and against gambling. If I know he was being paid by the pro-gaming people, of course it was going to be positive. So I would look then as an investigator, I would on my own look, okay, where's the truth? As you know, there's three sides to every story, yours, mine, and then somewhere in there's the truth. I would look at what is the real numbers. Now one of the things, like I said, you're going to hear rumors, innuendos the whole time. There's so many falsehoods out there about gaming nowadays. You're going to hear the crime goes up. That was one of my biggest concerns. Is crime going to go up? Prostitutes are going to be running around half naked. You know, our kids are going to be corrupted. My mother's going to be spending her whole Social Security check. Oh my gosh, you know, it's raining cats and dogs. What we actually found out was most of that stuff is not true. And then also it's how you look at the numbers. If anybody's ever dealt with statistics, statistics can be manipulated to your benefit any which way. And when I would go out and give speeches in Pennsylvania about crime and crime going up, I use the example, some numbers are going to go up because these casinos are attracting 10, 20,000 people a day. But is it really crime against the community? One of the crimes in Pennsylvania that went up was theft. You think serious. But what you had to look at, because we went to take it in, take it out of all our machines, no more coins or that, and when, after you get done, you want to go to another machine, you had to push the button and get a ticket to then take to a kiosk to cash in. Well, people weren't familiar with that, so they'd get up, walk away, leave the ticket in there. Somebody else would come in, oh, look, a ticket. Start playing or take it and cash it out. Person would come back, where's my ticket? They'd get in an argument, somebody was playing it, or they walked away. We had a rep there, the gaming board had a rep there, a compliance officer, they'd get a state policeman who was also stationed there. They'd look at the tape, okay, you're under arrest, or here's your ticket for theft. That's why the thefts went up, and it wasn't people getting robbed in the parking lot, even though we had a couple of those in Philadelphia. But we also had robberies by guys that were set up because they didn't want to tell their wife, they just lost their paycheck. But I use the analogy of Penn State and State College, where State College, during Monday through Thursday, during football season, has 28,000 people. They probably have one arrest a month for drunken driving and maybe, one and a half arrests for a fight, Monday through Thursday. Friday, football Friday, 150,000 people come to Penn State. 100,000 or 120,000 go to the game. The rest are at the bars drinking. There are fans from other schools there. The fights go up. The drunk go up. So the numbers go up for the crime. But is it really crime against the community? It's crime that's on that Friday or Saturday night, and then the community isn't at that big a threat. One of the new local newspapers, and there's an article on this, you can research it, because I actually gave it to the state of Florida, because they're looking at trying to legalize gaming, is they did a survey of 6 or 9 of the district attorneys where the casinos were located after the casinos had been up and running for at least 1.5 years, and asked them if their crime statistics had gone up. All but one responded, and every single one who responded no. You can Google that. It's a newspaper article. So you've got to look at what's behind the numbers, what's behind these rumors. The prostitution, we didn't see it. We got a couple of reports of, you know, guys going into bathrooms with their girlfriends at 3 o'clock in the morning, or this alleged girlfriend. Some of these stories and rumors that are out there are not really accurate.
Slight shift, but same general line of thought. Problem gaming. Could you speak to what Pennsylvania undertook to do about that from a regulatory standpoint and from actual experience?
We took that very seriously. Yeah. And the legislation mandated, I think it was $1.5 million a year to go to problem gaming program. We dedicated one of our people to Poncho the problem gaming and an assistant. Part of their requirements that we looked at was their active problem gaming program. What does that entail within the casinos? We required every casino to have an active problem gaming program. They had to have their people trained. They had to have legislation, PR material with the problem game. Do you have a problem gaming? And it couldn't be in little letters. We regulated the sign, how large those letters should be. People had to see it. The phone number. The management, the people were trained to look for somebody they thought had a problem with gaming, and then how to approach these people, how to talk to them. They publicized it. So even if I'm not going to admit I had a problem with gaming, people knew that they did. Their family members. Family members were able to come into the board and say, my father, my son, my mother has a problem with gaming. We need help. We then got involved. Our problem with gaming people got involved. They'd go back with the casino, look and pull. Okay, what is this guy gambling? And then we have the authority to exclude. Then put this person on an exclusion list. It's like, look, no, you can't come in here. Or they also have the ability. Is I have a problem eating French fries. So my wife keeps me out of McDonald's. When she tries to do it 6 months at a time, a year, I sneak in every now and then. And that's some of what we did with the game. You could put yourself on a self-exclusion list for 6 months, for a year, then come back in. But to come back in, to get off that list, you had to be interviewed. And you had to be interviewed by people that were trained in recognizing problem gaming. If you were on that exclusion list, if you had a problem gaming, were on that exclusion list. Because these casinos, we had a book, we had their pictures. Most of these people that gamble love these cards, you know, players' cards. So they had them flagged in their computer system and were able to know this person's playing. And if they were playing, this casino got fined. We fined the casino. And this was controversial, too, because even if they self-reported, they found it, they were required to report to us, and we then fined them. And that's how seriously we took it. And if they didn't report it to us, and we found out about it, they got fined even more for failing to disclose to us this violation.
If you haven't seen, say, street crime any greater than you might have seen, say, a football game or a hockey game, you know, any place where you draw people, what kinds of criminal activity or other problems have you run across at the casinos? Or investigation problems, cheating, like that?
Slot machine cheating is very difficult today, even though they're still trying to do it because the machines are computers and are getting so advanced. We were then concerned when the table games was first legalized. And we knew, and we brought in an expert from Las Vegas to teach our all our enforcement people and us how people cheat, how, and no disrespect to what I saw yesterday, but hand shuffling of cards. Oh my God, that's so easy to cheat, for the dealer to cheat by hand shuffling.
That reference about yesterday.
We went and visited one of the charitable games locations and saw the card game going on where they were just hand shuffling. All our table games with cards have an automatic shuffler machine. They have to put it in the shoe. It comes out of a shoe. But we brought in an expert from Las Vegas, world-renowned cheater, that is now, he's seen the light, as we say in law enforcement. He saw the light because he saw the badge first. taught us how to cheat, how to shuffle the cards without ever shuffling the cards. But as you do it, and the camera's watching you, and you're sitting there looking, you could swear he's shuffling the cards, but they're in the exact same order as he would do it. We trained our people on that. We knew that we were going to be targeted because all the other jurisdictions that we were dealing with and talking with, and in the regulatory frame, we're all in this together. And we talk to each other, and we share information we knew that these people were going to come and test us, and that's when they did. And part of the other thing we did is we stole away a lot of the expertise from New Jersey. Because while we were there, and I got to divulge, that's how I met Maureen. We stole her and hired her to come to the gaming board. We hired her husband to set up our lab. We hired some of their head of enforcement, a state trooper, the New Jersey Stall, who knew all the tricks. So we had people that also were there and trained, and we knew that we were going to be hit and looked at. So we watched that. I'm not aware of too many cheating. We had people trying to top it off where the cards would come out. He would win, and as the dealer was hitting you, he would try to put more chips on to get more money out of that. We had people trying to switch cards, but that then goes to your security surveillance system, the eye in the sky, where that's how that's important. Got to be manned 24/7. They don't interact with the people on the floor except to tell them, go to table so and so and watch that. And the guys in the surveillance room, watching the cameras, they do this and they're trained over and over again. And they can spot this, and we hope we do. Plus intelligence. We were warned by, I think it was Vegas or maybe West Virginia, that there was a way to beat one of the slot machines, the way it was played to pay out, to win 100, but then get it to pay out 1,000. And that information was relayed to us in like a bolo in law enforcement, be on the lookout for this scheme and that. And it was occurring at one of ours. We had some Asians from New York coming in, but that tried to cheat in our Mount Airy. But a lot of these people are known, and those are the ones you got to look out for. The locals who try to cheat, they're as clumsy, as an ox. They're looking around and they put it on, quick motion. Pushing it away. Those you'll see. But then what happens? They're arrested. They go to jail. And then that's what one of the things we had to do, and I got involved with the local judiciary, is because underage gaming became a problem for us. People sneaking in. The drinking age when I was growing up in New York was 18. And I went to college then in Pennsylvania, 21. Point, I've been drinking, so I'm going to try to get into a bar in Pennsylvania because I'm legal to drink in New York. It's the same sort of thing where these people, we had people trying to sneak in underage. We would hammer even if they were found by the casino was fined, underage. And for every occurrence, the fine kept on going up to get their attention. We would suggest they were responsible for enforcing their own internal controls. They wrote the internal controls. We approved them, but they were responsible for enforcing it. We didn't tell them, put security here, 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 and here. Look, if people keep getting in, you only have one guy there, they're rushing you through, and you better put somebody else there, because the next time the fine is going to be $25,000 versus $10,000. So not only were they fined, but the person was arrested. And this then became a sore spot, because some of the courts, we all did this when we were younger. Don't do it again. And we say, wait a minute, especially around some of the college towns. You can't set this message out there that you're going to slap them on the hand. It's got to be substantial. And the courts started coming around because, wait a minute, this is the sixth student from Pitt that we've caught here. The word is out. You go through this door here. That you can. This is how you get in. That's some of the underage gaming. It was something significant. You can go to the website, and then we publicized. Everything was transparent. We put everything on the websites, the Pennsylvania Gaming Control website, the monthly win, the revenue, incidents, reports, and we had a little bit of public hearing. How the board went, we had some of these checks and balances. We had investigators. Investigators are so important. They did, first of all, the background checks. Background checks are so important in this business. Is you got to do thorough background checks. And the state police, attorney general's office, investigators, criminal investigators are great criminal investigators. There's a difference I learned between a regulatory background investigation, that there is information that we considered as criminal investigators that was important. The word on the street is, the rumor is, my informant's telling me this. Well, there's no substantiation. There's no evidence or proof. But in a regulatory license in Pennsylvania, we were not allowed by law to use any of that information when we were considering issuing license to people, which caused us some problems. We had to explain this publicly and then to a grand jury why we came up with this. Because one of the things that happened was the investigators were criminal investigators. A lot of them we hired from retired detectives, retired FBI, and they weren't used to the regulatory environment. So we had the investigators doing thorough background checks, financial. You have to divulge everything in your life for key employees. But we then had another independent group within our Bureau of Investigation, the lawyers, who then looked at it from a legal standpoint that said, okay, this can't go to the commissioners, this can't go to the commissioners, we've got to take this out of that. Some of the investigators got all upset. Well, you're taking stuff out of my report. They should need to know that. We, as regulators in our quasi-judicial role, were not allowed by law to see that. The other thing is they were independent. We were not allowed as commissioners to direct them. They were directed by the head of the Bureau of Investigation, the chief counsel, the chief enforcement counsel, who had the final say, who was an attorney, and look at it. Then he was the one, and they would then present that to the board for adjudication. And we would then make a determination based, they would make a recommendation, license the person, don't license the person. We would have a hearing, and then we would either issue or not issue the license.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. Pennsylvania has been one of the states that New Hampshire had looked to, predominantly because when our legislation first started, we were looking at four racetracks, so emulating maybe what Pennsylvania did with their racinos. Well, since then, it's been now multiple governors that are down to one location, maybe a second location. But also, unlike Pennsylvania, we have very, very strong local control where no state entity can say you're going to have a casino in your town because it has to have local vote. Well, we know that one of our communities in this state took that vote, and over 80% of the people would be happy to have it because they've got a racetrack. But I guess comments from you, because that adds another dimension about how do you stay neutral, or how do you not have the feedback about a fix is in, and because you have a limited location, you have to have local control. It it seems like in some ways you had more flexibility than we have to. So how, I want to make sure we keep the process so you don't get, well, the fits was in.
You're going to get that no matter what happens. Okay, realize you're never going to convince a certain group of people that it's not bad, or the fix wasn't in, or he didn't get this because of he was the friends of the governor, minority, whatever. There's that group that you'll never convince. If you have to do what is best and what fits with New Hampshire. One of the things I learned going around to all the different jurisdictions is everybody works in a different legal environment. Every state is different. There's the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There's the state of this, New Jersey. You got to do what's right for you based on your laws, traditions, and the legislative intent. If you have these criteria, which we did, and you set your own criteria, what do you feel is important to make a decision? One of the big things that in the law was economic impact. The direction that the laws told us is try to pick the casino that will make the most money for Pennsylvania. That was one of the criteria. Then it was, community input, financial wherewithal. Not only to run this casino if we give them the license for the first year, but what is it, are they able to run it for 3 years, for 5 years? You set that criteria you want. Then, and a lot of this is you got to look yourself in the mirror because, like I say, the naysayers are going to be out there. They're going to say this. You go through this process, and each individual is going to have their own opinion. I like this casino better than this casino. With us, we had to all agree. So we had to sit down and you got to convince me why you think yours is better than mine. And I'm going to try to convince you mine is better than yours, sort of thing. You do all that. You're able to defend that, and like I said, we had to. I have had to do it publicly on the news, TV, and in a grand jury. How and why we did this, because of all those accusations. And I'm proud to say, none of us have been indicted. None of us have. People are looking back at what the original commissioners have done. And in fact, there was a recent article written about that hey, maybe we weren't as bad, things weren't as bad as people were saying back then. And what it was also nice to see, because I was on there 6.5 years and pretty much everybody had gone before, when the new people came on board, they all, man, you got to go in there and straighten things out. Because even our legislative appointees, and I got a call to pass one time, all you're doing is rubber stamping, what the chairman wants. No, you don't realize what all's going on. Where when the new appointees came in after getting this guidance, you got to correct what McKay did and what so-and-so, they found we did nothing wrong. They would then go back and report, they're doing everything right. Everything's above. I don't see what you're saying. So that then reinforced to our appointees to not listen to what's being put in the press, not listen to the rumor mill, not listen to what the naysayers are. There is a lot of money involved in gaming. And the losers will spend a lot of money to try to get the winners eliminated or pulled or find something legally wrong. Like I said, Trump sued us so many times. He sued us for not giving him the license. And then when we pulled Foxwoods' license, he then sued us to give him that license. And we're saying, well, wait a minute, what about the competitive process? What about, he just wanted, okay, we pull Foxwoods, give it to him.
Okay.
So I guess you got to look at yourself in the mirror, set your criteria, and then you're going to have to live, and your family is going to have to live with the decisions you make, and then the negative, there's going to be negative people, and there's going to be positive people.
Okay. I want to say that we're going to take a few more minutes, just so you're aware we're going to run out of time. And I know that Senator Rush has a follow-up, and others may have questions, and I've got a couple. So we've got a time constraint. And
please ask. Just ask, and I'll try to make it succinct. As you see, I have no problem talking. because I feel I got so much. Yeah, I tell people I used to have three sides of my brain. Stuff that I can talk about, secret stuff that I can't talk about, and the other part is empty.
Senator Rush, yes, and I apologize for asking so many questions, but one of the things that comes up is the background checks on these licensees. But yet, as I hear you speak to the fact that a lot of these are multi-jurisdictional. They're in this state, this state, this state, this state. And all of them want to make sure that they don't lose a license over there because it's going to affect them. So when it comes to that background check, they talk about we have to take gobs of time to do these background checks. But if these are known entities that they're licensed in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Michigan and Las Vegas, isn't there a piggyback on that? That, you know, yes. We look at some of your work when we look at the mirror.
Yes, there is. There's a multi-jurisdictional or multi-state application, but each state puts their own nuance on it. There are people that Las Vegas would license that Pennsylvania wouldn't license. One big case was in New Jersey and Las Vegas. Las Vegas allowed MGM to get a partnership with Stanley Ho's daughter, I don't remember her name. And New Jersey said, MGM, if you go in partnership with her, you got to sell your interest in your Atlantic City casino. And they waited and said, we're going to sell. So there is a little idiosyncrasies for each jurisdiction and criteria. What will you accept? A lot of times for the key employees, and we have written in our statute that if, in fact, their license and another, we could expedite things and use some of that on a temporary basis. But we had our own little nuances, and every jurisdiction should.
Attorney General,
a quick question. How many licenses are there today?
There's still 14 licenses by law. There are 13 that have been awarded. No, 12 that have been awarded. They're up and running. The one racetrack license has still not been awarded. And then the one Philadelphia Category 2 open casino, major casino, has not been awarded. It was awarded to Foxwoods, and we pulled it, and now it's going through the application phase.
So what then, but is the second largest jurisdiction now in terms of total gaming?
It's total gaming, yeah.
Second largest,
right now. Revenue generated.
Yeah, and could you comment why that is?
Because our tax is 55% on the slot machines, and we started out on the table games at 16%. We had different taxation rates. 55% tax rate on the slots, and then when the table games came in, initially 16% for 2 years, and then it was going down to 14%. That's the reason why we're one of the highest. Pennsylvania is one of the highest taxation. We charge $50 million a license for the racetracks and the five standalone, and $5 million for the two resort license. There was a debate about that. Should you put it out there for bid? We could get more money from that. That is what the legislature agreed upon. Is we're going to sell for $50 million.
Did you have any requirements for construction, for investment in the property?
Not for investing in the property. You know, a lot of them had identified sites before, and that was part of the process. Okay, where are you putting your casino? It wasn't just, I'm here, I want a casino license, give them the license, and then they go out and look for a place. They already had a location, and that helped. That was part of how we determined where we wanted to put it.
No minimum. You need to invest $50 million in this site order to be in.
No, we didn't put anything like that.
All right.
But also the construction workers and everybody had to be licensed. And
Representative Webley.
I was interested in listening in passing to you say something about the length of time that the licenses ran for. How long are your casinos licenses for, and what are the
renewal
rates?
Quick to the renewal answer terms? Is three years. Every 3 years they have to be renewed, and we have to go through the public input phase, where the public gets to talk, comment on the act of the casino. How have they been good community neighbors? Have they done what they said they were going to do? They had to make a presentation to the board to tell us what they had done, community, and boom, boom, boom. Then we looked at how many incidences, and then we renewed it. And one of the things, when we wrote our rules and regulations, we let it be known that these are a living, breathing document, that as we grow and as we learn, we're going to be able to change, we want to be able to change these. Nothing was written in stone. And we started off tough, and in certain areas we acquiesced or listened to what the casinos were saying. One of them is we initially put 1 year renewal on everybody, and we couldn't handle it with the background checks and, you know, all this. It was like, well, if we want to do this right, and then we staggered them, so it's now 3 years.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning, Kevin. Two-part question. One of the things we're going to be asked to do is what this board is going to look like. And is it going to be, there's different ways to go about it. One is it going to be a standalone board dealing with commercial gaming? Is it going to be a board that includes lottery, as we've heard in some states, as the two come together? And then we have the entity of charitable gaming, which you saw. So do you have any thoughts on how this board should look? That's number one. And then the second part is, knowing that you saw charitable gaming, we've had testimony that if we keep charitable gaming in its current form, that the regulatory environment for charitable gaming should be similar, the requirements should be similar to traditional commercial gaming.
Only thoughts. No experience. I'm speaking from what I've seen here and in Florida, where I'm currently living. I think the board should be independent. The standalone board with that we really didn't answer to anybody. We didn't answer to our appointing authority. We thought we answered to the people of Pennsylvania. We should answer to the people of New Hampshire. The lottery stood alone. The racing commission stood alone. We had liaison with them, we worked closely with them, but they each worked independent from us. You could not get, the horse racing commission had to license you as a horse racetrack before you could apply for our license. So we didn't do anything until they did. We had no influence over them. About being regulated, being taxed, this is what's happening in Florida right now, is they're trying to look at, okay, should we legalize gaming? But you have all these different entities. We have the internet cafes, you have the Seminole Indians, you have the cruise ships, you have the tracks that have dog tracks and horse tracks that have slot machines. Then you have the new people coming in, the gaming people like Genting and Sands, Sheldon Allison, who's coming in. They couldn't get it passed, but they couldn't get everybody to agree, where the existing tracks are being taxed 35%. The two big guys that wanted to come in, Genting and Shelton, Allison and Sands, they wanted their casino resorts to be taxed at 15%. So the existing ones are saying, wait a minute, this isn't fair. So personally, you should make a level playing ground for everybody. Everybody should follow the same rules. There shouldn't be, you know, certain different rules for different people. Again, you know, that is just something
standalone board.
Yeah, standalone board. Yeah. If you're going to have gambling, gambling's gambling, and it should be under one group. Horse racing is different. You know, you can keep them separate. Lottery, keep them separate. Because then you have the casinos paying for the board, and you're. We generated $5.1 billion in revenue for the state, and we didn't cost the state a cent. All our expenses, rental cars, trips, everything, we had a budget, and the budget was approved by the legislature, but it was funded by the casinos.
Thank you.
Yes,
regarding the auditors and the inspectors and like that at these gaming, how is that determined? How would you establish that?
We had an audit staff located at our headquarters that went out. And each casino, we had our casino enforcement officers who made sure that the casino was enforcing their own internal controls. They were also there for the public, and the public knew they were there. That if there was a dispute on this machine, I thought I won the jackpot and it's not paying me. I went to casino rep, the enforcement, the board rep here. They would come. They would then adjudicate, a lot of times right on spot. They'd go look at the machine. They'd pull the history of it. They'd look at the surveillance tapes and make a determination. We tried to have at least two on board for every 8-hour period because we had them open 24/7 with the supervisor. Audits we tried to do, again, on a rotating basis, but after also we had to learn how do you do a casino audit. We had Pricewaterhouse help us on a couple, and then from there we took it over. And the other thing, issuing the license, before we as a board issued the license, we had these independent groups that were under us, under oath, publicly had to state, law enforcement had to say, yes, we find them suitable. Financial people had to come out publicly say, fine, yes, they're suitable, before we as a board made a decision. And they had the opportunity to say, no, we don't. And then we would ask them questions. So there was that checks and balances there, too. And publicly, it also covered our butt. Because, wait a minute, you had a chance to tell us you didn't agree that he should be licensed. Well, that's your job. That's why we're paying you. We want your honest opinion.
Okay, I've got a couple of quick questions on discrete issues. One is local employment. I think you referenced a preference for local employment. How did that play out?
Excellent. 93% of the employees of the casinos were locally hired. We realized at the beginning that the management of the casino, we did not have that expertise in Pennsylvania. So we knew it was going to come from Las Vegas, existing jurisdictions. And to this day, the Pennsylvania is enforcing that. And part of what we saw is the people that were hired, they were Pennsylvania people, now have moved up into a lot of those management positions. They now have that experience. So that has continued. Diversity. There's a diversity report every year. We monitored that. And we not only looked at the diversity at the lower ranks, so to speak, of numbers, we wanted to know what was your diversity in the management ranks of your casino. And we enforced that. And that was part of their conditions to continue to get their license. When their license got renewed, that was what we asked. So how many of these are Pennsylvania residents? What's your diversity numbers? They're not good. We want them better. Or, okay, they're good. And they were compared to the local community.
Did you have a rule that says you shall hire from the local community, or did you ask the casino operators to give you a plan for giving preference for local employment? How did it operate?
I know we told them we wanted to hire a local. I don't know if we had a rule or a law, but we said this is the economic development for the state of Pennsylvania. We saw all these billions of dollars going to New Jersey, West Virginia, and Las Vegas. We wanted to keep that money in Pennsylvania, and we wanted to improve the life of Pennsylvanians. So we demanded that they hire locally with livable wages and benefits.
Okay, then switching gears to a different topic. There's been concern expressed by theaters, local entertainment places, that they're going to be put out of business. They're going to lose business with the coming of a big, you know, casino with entertainment space, and an interest in seeing if some of that concern can be abated by rules or...
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And we heard the same thing. Yeah. And we looked at that. One of the things, are they going to give liquor away or not? Are they going to give food away or not? And we heard those concerns. And what we had them do and what those casinos have done, and I can give you name by name, and to me it's pretty impressive. They have embraced the community. They have embraced the local economy to provide them with what they need. If they... In one casino, The owner of that Racino went out, and in the food court that he made, he went and got the local businesses and said, I want a sandwich shop there, I want an ice cream shop, will you move your ice cream shop here? They did that. They embraced them. The hotels were afraid. What the casinos did was, look, we will provide you a free shuttle from your hotel to our casino, and when they had hotels, and when we're booked, we're going to refer these people to you. And then at no cost to you, we're going to then shuttle them over here. So they did that to embrace. The same casino with the food court went out to the local restaurant and said, look, for our beginning players, after they spend $100, we want to give them a bonus, a thing. We'd like to give them a dinner at your restaurant, and a $25 dinner. Oh, great. Well, how many tickets do you want? Well, start me out with 1,000. Wait a minute, 1,000? That's more business than we have done in a year. You want it for the first 6 months? And that's what happened. And what we saw, they bought locally bakeries. They were purchasing from there. The toilet paper, stuff you don't make. Toilet paper, they bought locally. We had them buy locally. If you're going to put a car there, you're going to get it from the local dealership to wrap, to play that. And we have not seen, and we looked at what happened in New Jersey. No disrespect, I always look at these guys, no disrespect to New Jersey. We saw what happened in the surrounding community because they didn't embrace them initially and include them in. We were pretty happy and successful, and I don't know of any businesses going out of business because of the existence of the casino. And I know a number of examples of businesses increasing because of the presence of the casino.
Okay. I think we got to call this, unless you have some closing words of wisdom, call this.
I thank you for the opportunity to pay this forward, the courtesy that we were given early on when we were first setting up our gaming board and the licensing procedures of having gone around to different jurisdictions to see how they would do it. I wish you the best. Well, I know what you're going through. I went through it. Prepare your families for what, is going to happen. Realize that there's a certain group of people you're never going to make happy and will always think that you were corrupt, that the fix was in or whatever. And you got to know it's not. And the regulatory system, we work together, and the industry, I learned, wants it. They want a strong regulatory environment so they can prosper, and people will trust what they're doing and come to their casinos. Thank you again, and I'm more than happy to help you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to just move right on. Are you ready, Jim?
Well, I apologize in advance. I don't have anywhere near as much story.
So we have Jim Nickerson from White Sand Gaming, who's going to talk with us about FESCO and capacity issues. And I'll leave it to Jim to define that more fully.
I'll touch on those. I guess first of all, I want to thank everyone for the opportunity for us to be here today, and really thank you for selecting White Sand. We appreciate the confidence, and we know we're going to do a good job and be your partners moving forward. So we look forward to that. Myself, actually, back in the 80s, I taught finance and management at a state college in southern New Jersey outside of Atlantic City, and had a lot of casino workers in my classes, and I was enticed to get into the industry back in the 80s. My background was in finance and technology. So I started working for Showboat at the time, Showboat Inc., and we opened, actually, as far as new jurisdictions, we opened the first legal gaming in Louisiana, Lake Pontchartrain, East Chicago, Indiana, and two properties in Sydney, Australia before we were purchased by Harris Entertainment. And actually left for a while the industry to go work at KPMG and then PricewaterhouseCoopers in their gaming practices. And was fortunate enough in 2001 with my associate Sal Sherry to
formed White Sand Gaming back in 2001, and since then I've been active in many, many new jurisdictions, and you know, our paths have crossed over the years, and I think we've put together a good team. As far as my responsibility, I know you heard from Maureen over the past few weeks and the great job she's doing in the areas that she's addressing and working on. And in addition to helping Maureen with things like technical standards, pay table ratios, things like that, some of the other technical aspects to her work, we're also addressing the fiscal capacity requirements of any potential gaming in New Hampshire. And we will look at, and there are many different models. Again, just to preface, there are a lot of different models, as Ken mentioned, and that it's not one size fits all. That what worked in other states may not be right for the goals and objectives of moving down this road in New Hampshire. So we will look at a number of these things. There are different ways to do things. We definitely have opinions. We definitely have things that we'll look at and present. But it's really understanding what the goals are. What is really the intent of moving forward with legalized gaming. We feel strongly about that. And I think in Pennsylvania, it was really no secret. It was a jobs bill. I mean, we're going to, number one, keep the money in the state. But also, we're going to hire people. If we develop a 325 person, that's good, because we're hiring people. And that was part of the plan at that time. But we will look at capital investment. Given you've been looking at the demographics, and actually I've been impressed that really when you start drawing your 30, 60, 90 mile rings on the area, that what the potential market is, and so we're looking at that. What the potential capital investment would be, what should the license fees be, what should the application fees be. Again, if these one-time hits to generate revenue, or these investments moving forward, even to some smaller things like unclaimed winnings. What happens with those tickets that maybe they're not stolen at the machine, but they find a lot of small ones. And a lot of it's there's a lot of small tickets left. Oh, it's only 35 cents. It's not worth standing at the cage or at that kiosk. So I'll just take it and I'll use it next time, or I'll take this $10 and I just never go back. So there are a lot of unclaimed winnings. Tax rate, which is always the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Again, different philosophies. I mean, we see tax rates everywhere from 8% to 67%. So suits the way that New Hampshire wants to go. The slot machines themselves, and you're right, they're computers, but they're complicated computers, and with new games, with new product, how they calculate winnings, what are the different ways I can win, and what do the pay tables look like? This is something else that we'll address there. Just as Maureen is looking at the comparator states as far as what the regulatory infrastructure looks like, we're going to look at that on a revenue basis, an investment basis, a win per unit basis. A lot of how revenue is one of the shortcuts and buzzwords is win per unit. That's one way to measure success or measure revenue is these machines, whether it's a VLT or a slot machine or a table game. What is the win per unit? And that times your number of units times the number of days in a year will give you where the revenue would probably be. So we are looking at not only the comparator states, but also trying to pick out, not necessarily within those states, but what would a property somewhere in New Hampshire look like, and actually help us develop our models that way. So we're looking at other things that kind of match the demographics, the potential size, the investment, so that we can do some comparisons there. And from those models, again, do the revenue projections for the property, but also revenue projections for the state of New Hampshire. Demographics are important, not only just population, but the propensity to game, which has, go figure, gone up over the years, and higher in some geographic areas than others. But we'll look at the propensity to game, disposable income, age, again, just all the demographic demographic data that goes into these calculations and comparisons. And again, from that, use our competitive set to actually validate that and be able, and that will all be in the report as well. I could go, you know, explain any of those in more detail, but I just really, at this point, really no numbers to share at this point, although we're rapidly getting to the point over the next few weeks where we'll have more specific data to share, but really just an overview of the financial and capacity requirements that we're looking at this time.
Yes.
I was just going to say, and one of the things that interested me or perplexes me in all of this, particularly as we're looking at very low numbers, and the number we most often look at right now is one, because one of the charges we had was to evaluate the proposal we had from last time, is how you calculate, and I don't need to know how you calculate this, I just need you to know that this is what concerns me, is the issue of how long you run a license out for an operator who you have required to pay, to outlay a significant amount of money. You know, it's clear to me that if you have to have an operator be able to run a sustainable operation, or the whole thing's going to turn into a terrific mess. But how do you optimize both the money into the state and the control going forward for the state? And how do you balance out time periods of licensing versus investment and return to everybody? And as I say, I don't need to know how you calculate that, but that's the thing that I'm hoping we'll get some guidance on going forward.
Absolutely. Again, I think it was mentioned, I know by Maureen, I think by Ken, that what the operators want is just to know what the rules are. Right. Let me know the framework, and then, hey, I'm good at figuring out how I can best operate, or if I want to operate within that framework. But they just want to know it's a stable environment, you know, the regulations, okay, that's like X jurisdiction, or that's a common, okay, I know how to deal with that. Let me do my homework, and I'll come up with how big it should be, and so on, if I want to participate. I've seen that, and really, what they do in Pennsylvania, I think it's an outline, is it's actually, the license, there's no end date. They do renew them, they just want to make sure at a specific period of time. Is it 3 years, is it 4 years, is it 5 years? But you go through the process of review. And it's theirs to lose. So as long as they're holding up what they committed to, and as long as they're playing by the rules and they're paying their taxes, and it's on the up and up, that it's perpetual, and it's theirs to really lose. So, and that I think most of can deal with. And that's a stable environment. That okay, as long as I do, because you know I operate in 5-10 jurisdictions, and I can't get in trouble here because it does affect. All over. I mean, they find out, be on the lookout for it right away.
We also, so not only is it there to lose, but we also governed and regulated their sale. Some of them will start their casino, get it going, and then somebody else will come in and I want to buy it from them. So we also then control that and that whole process, and we charge them money also from somebody wanting to come in and buy. So, yeah, the license in Pennsylvania is forever and ever based on 3-year renewals. But if you want to sell it, sure, if you want to sell it, you can sell it, but with the approval of the board.
I think one thing that's different, again, where one size does not fit all, is Pennsylvania is a big state. I've driven, because I've worked here on the east side, Philadelphia, Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, but also in Pittsburgh, and I drove it a few times, and it's a six. Hour plus ride from just to go across, and they have 12 locations. So, what makes sense there? Some of the aspects of their operation would be different where there's one or a smaller jurisdiction.
Yeah, we've got a question here.
Yes, sir, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
How many employees does Pennsylvania have? The Gaming Control Board.
Total. We had when I left, I think it was about 234 or 236. And that included our casino enforcement officers, yes, out in the casinos, what we call our Bureau of Investigation Enforcement, Chief Counsel's Office, our financial, our hearings and appeals, because we had the whole due process went through our process, and then we were like the Supreme Court. So, you know, we have a multifaceted one government agency.
Something to follow up. Yeah. So all the independent groups you were discussing are all contained within that structure.
Yeah. We had an executive director that ran it day to day.
I mean, the politics, because we worked in many jurisdictions, that the there was a point there. In Pennsylvania, it was interesting, an evaluation from state to state, which departments, with the Attorney General, the state police, a lot of, you know, how they interacted, whether they wanted to buy in and be involved, or whether they, you know, they didn't want to be, and it varies from state to state. In Pennsylvania, state police were very involved, and in fact, as part of the act, I don't know where it fell in regulatory-wise, but there was a barracks built at each of these 14 locations.
In the facility. With a holding cell for the casinos. They developed their own casino. And again, politics, empire building.
Right.
And then there was, at the time, the Attorney General didn't want anything to do with it, because he was running for governor in his own mind. He was running for, and he won 8 years later when this first started.
I guess to that question.
If I could just ask a question.
Yes.
Certainly. I'll yield mine to the Commissioner of Safety.
Relationships between state and local are critically important, and I don't think that model of building barracks is going to work here in New Hampshire. Can you speak to your experience in building a model where you have a close working relationship between state and local?
Well, in New Jersey, and Marie can correct me on that.
Basically, you know, when you look at, you got to be careful looking at numbers of agencies, because in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board is fairly self-contained. So when you have the Bureau of Investigation and Enforcement and the lawyers and investigators there, that's functioning as the Attorney General's office does in New Jersey. So when you see 350 people in an agency in Pennsylvania, and then you say, oh, but there's only 150 people with the Casino Control Commission, that's sort of an apples and oranges, because there's 150 people with the Casino Control Commission and 200 people with the Division of Gaming Enforcement, and another 50 people with, you know, criminal justice, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it really depends on the structure. And in Pennsylvania, they had a single gaming agency with an insulated Bureau of Investigation and Enforcement that basically did the background investigation function. And that's the model that Massachusetts is essentially following. If you notice, in Pennsylvania, there's a Bureau of Investigation and Enforcement. In Massachusetts, there's going to be an Investigation and Enforcement Bureau. So, but again, the functionality is pretty much the same.
I think to address... the state police only had jurisdiction on the casino floor.
Okay. Right.
So even if there was an attached hotel or the parking lot out front, that was local.
They work well together, especially in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, where everybody sat down and said, okay, because the local community is getting up to $10 million because of that casino being there, and I had $5 million to give to law enforcement every year. So the local police were able to hire more law enforcement. They were able to buy equipment because of having that casino there. And there was a good relationship. And in some places, the state police were the only law enforcement. There was no local community.
With the geographic, the way Pennsylvania awarded licenses and regionalized it, it turned out that at the end of 12 or 14 properties, there was a really good coverage of the entire state. And these barracks were there to serve the gaming operation, but they also had statewide emergency communication equipment and everything else. So some of their facilities and some of their resources were dedicated for well beyond the gaming purpose. It happened that that was a good place. Can I forget there were different types of communication equipment and things, and so it was sort of multi-purpose.
Thank you. Patrick. You want to follow up on this?
Yeah, no, I was yielded the floor and lost it.
go for it.
I guess to follow up that point and finish it, I guess the question is, how important is it to delineate ahead of time who does what, where, when, before you start building it, in terms of the legislation going forward?
I think very important. I'll use an example of, but also not only important to get it beforehand, but to get the people talking. They had a drunk driver leave the casino up in Erie, and the local jurisdiction is the state police. Well, the gaming state police thought they couldn't go out of the building. This drunken driver, everybody saw him drunk, get in the car. They called the local barracks to come and try to, you know, stop this guy. And he went out, and he got away. There was no sad story to this. But there was confusion, and all this confusion was done in front of a reporter. And, of course, that was reported, and it was kind of embarrassing to everybody. Wait a minute. I mean, you know, these guys can't go out. They thought they couldn't go out, and, yeah, they can. So it's important, you know, what's your responsibility? Investigating crime on the gaming floor, money laundering investigations, that sort of thing, and how to work and interact with the local jurisdiction.
Patrick.
Yeah, good morning. Just one question I had was in a follow-up to, you said you have $5 million to give to law enforcement. Is that money that came from, say, tax revenues that went to the local community and then they chose?
That was in addition to up to the $10 million that went to the local community, but it was to fight illegal gambling, and I couldn't give that money away. I was a member of every, you know, chiefs of police because I was the head of the FBI beforehand, and I'd go into these meetings and say, guys, yeah, I can give you $250,000. I can give you $500,000. And some took it. Pittsburgh took it. I was able to get some $50,000 here. But a lot of them said, Kenny, my mayor won't let me do it. My city councilman, because his brother-in-law has some of these illegal slot machines in his bar. They're in the firehouse. They're here. And you know, we don't want to touch it. So we ended up lowering that $5 million to $2.5 million.
Those are monies that were set aside in addition to the budgets that were already, say, prescribed to the gaming enforcement unit, local law enforcement, things like that. It was almost money above and beyond their budgets that you...
Yep.
Interesting. Thank you.
A point of confusion, or consternation maybe, is this range in tax rates from... high, you said, was 66 or so, and down to 8%, as you look across the states. And then there are licensing fees, and there are investment requirements. Is there any formula out there that allows one to look at a state like New Hampshire and translate all this into, well, this is the range for New Hampshire?
Again, it's somewhat philosophical. Las Vegas has always been the lowest, and in fact, they both, Las Vegas and New Jersey, both have an 8% base, but then in New Jersey, there's another 1.5% kind of goes to local redevelopment, so it's 8 plus 1.8. So those are the two lowest, and then you see other states gradually up to, Pennsylvania was the highest at 55 until Maryland just surpassed them at a net sort of 67%. And again, a lot of that, it's philosophical. There is a trade-off between a tax rate and what will be invested, and maybe the quality, the size, the quality. Do you really want a resort experience, or is it a slot warehouse, or a less fancy building with, you know, slot machines?
Let me just speak to that, because I didn't hear that Pennsylvania wound up with slot warehouses.
I know
what you're talking about, yeah. And yet their tax rate is very high. How did they get away with it?
Population. I think there was a lot of supply and demand that it will keep them, because you'll see people will go locally during the week. They'll go for their slot machine or table game experience, but they'll still go to Las Vegas, you know, on vacation, because that's still main draw for people who like to gamble. Or they may still go down to the shore in New Jersey on the weekends, because if I play 4 hours, I'm more likely to get a buffet. They're trained to that, because the more I pay in tax, the less I can reinvest in my property and grow and make it larger, or paint the floor, or paint the walls when they need it, or reinvest in my patron who comes, and they're trained in certain places. They can't go play X number of hours and get a room or get a buffet or get a ticket for something. So it's a trade-off between revenue now, and we don't care, versus we'll work with you. We'll let you reinvest, maybe build a hotel. There's a number of properties that don't have hotels that they just built, and there was others that were slow. And a lot of that was with the recession, too. That was actually all set up pre the economy had a problem. So there's some periods of struggle now, because the business is down, people don't have the discretionary income, and yet I'm still paying these taxes. So the couples were scolded, I think, for not fulfilling all the promises in a certain period of time, because they couldn't.
What time frame were we talking about from in Pennsylvania, from the passage of the law to the appointment of your commission, how long? And then from the appointment of the commission, how long till the first license was awarded, and how long till the first casino opened?
Okay, good, excellent question. The law was passed, like I said, in the early morning hours of July 4th, 2004. We issued the license in 2005, December?
We opened Mohegan Sun's, that was
2006.
Right? 2006. We started the construction all that 2005. We opened
what
in
month
2006.
Was that?
I want to say fall, September, October. Yeah.
Okay, so it was like a year and a half before we issued the license, and then almost two years when the first casino was up and running. And it was really, this is now some of the nuances that go on, a temporary casino, where it wasn't the what is there today at Mohegan Sun. And it was because it was also part of a racetrack. So they used the existing building to put the slots in, to then generate income to be able to build a beautiful full casino in phase two, as they say. And they had to get our approval to do their phase one, phase two sort of thing. And they were the first ones to open. And they were open because they were the racetrack. There was no lawsuits against them. Well, the standalone casinos, it took 3-4 years because of different types of lawsuits.
I have a question.
Yeah, thank you.
You're not going to pass and then a year later have them up and run. It's going to take a couple years. But then you got to also look at, will they build a temporary casino to then make it even nicer?
Director McIntyre.
question. You had said that there are several members of the board that have a functional veto power. Their veto power. The members who are appointed by the Senate House have veto power. And then you would use it once for 6 months. Did others use that as well? And did that cause a delay in the process going forward?
It was myself and the legislator appointed. We used it against each other. He's the one that wanted to divvy up the state for suppliers and force the casinos to buy from that little jurisdiction. And when he said, I said, wait a minute, that BS, I think that's just political payback because of the people that were going to be the suppliers, I'm not going to stand for it. So he proposed that for a vote. I voted no. And then I proposed a free market that they could buy from any place. And it was 6-1 for his, me voting against it, so it failed. And then we voted on mine. It was 6-1, for mine, and he voted against it. So he and I kind of, for 6 months,
I wouldn't give and he wouldn't give, and eventually he gave. And was, you know, the free market, because the other commissioners were working on too, say, look, you know, this just stinks. You know, you're just doing this to help some of your buddies and that sort of thing, and we're not going to let it go.
So would you recommend building into a new authority a functional veto for...
No, I don't know if I would. Because, you know, there were times that I was like wishy-washy, and if I could have voted no just because for principle, I would have, but then I would have ruined everything. And there was nothing hard that I could, I didn't have the hard evidence to vote no, I didn't have any facts to support it, because I was asked that at one point, in fact, in the grand jury, and by my caucus, but didn't in your gut you know you should vote no? I said, look, I had the gut feeling from law, from the FBI, but we were going to be sued. We knew that, no matter which way we went. And if I got on the stand, having been on the stand many times as an agent, and okay, Commissioner McCabe, why did you vote no and deprive my client of a livelihood? Well, I had a gut feeling. A gut feeling? What was that based on? I heard rumors. What rumors? You're basing your decisions on rumors, innuendos, and gut feeling, and you were an FBI agent that was supposed to deal with the facts, you know, Joe Friday, just the facts man. I could personally have been liable at that point for, you know, being derelict.
Okay.
So that's why I...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of the things you're talking about, like vendors and that, I believe we are just too small of a state. I don't see how that would be functional. But because we're a small state, demographically, we really, I view that if this is to be done, because Massachusetts has gambling, we're in a competitive environment. And what I am wondering on, that statistically we will draw heavily from Massachusetts, but then there is that first in, you know, who has the first location, the first build out, and just wondering what your thoughts are on how critical is the first in when it comes to a state that is small. I don't know that Pennsylvania had that same parameters because you have such a land mass and such a population base, but we border a significant competitor that we compete on multiple things. Thoughts on the first in?
Well, first in I think is important because people will try it. Everybody will give it a taste. And it's all about the experience, because if you think about gaming, it's have people come in and lose their money and have a good time. So, you know, that's, you know, that's the, it's about the experience. It's like, it's entertainment. It's so the first try is, but they will try out the second and the third, and it'll, and you know, they do build up loyalty. There's player club, but they will try it. They have a good time. They'll come back. So I think first in is important, but I think putting out a quality product that people will want to return to and have a good time. They'll tell their friends, gee, I had a good time there. And obviously, yes, you are going to compete with, to some degree, well, Spain feels like 100 miles, but you get an hour to Boston. I mean, there's going to be competition there, but obviously when we draw the rings, you're looking significantly into Massachusetts for that customer base.
Okay, General Boston.
Is there any casino in Pennsylvania that would look like a Mohegan Sun or a Foxwoods or one of the grand ones? Are there any very large-scale casinos in Pennsylvania with that 55% tax rate? Is there something that looks like a Mohegan Sun or some of the larger ones in Atlantic City, or are they smaller facilities?
Ours are good medium size. We have, you know, the Rivers is a beautiful casino, the Sands, Mount Airy. They're not the size of Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun. I've been to Mohegan Sun in Connecticut, not Foxwoods. I was at one of them one time. But again, it goes to what he says, that they need to be built to survive in the community that they're located in. That's a mistake a lot of maybe
new entrepreneurs in the gaming business will do is they'll come in and want to build a big Las Vegas-style casino, all these restaurants, entertainment, but the base that they're drawn from can't support it, and they go under.
But with a population like Greater Philadelphia, I mean, it's got a lot of population, so the tax rate does drive what's built, I'm assuming. I mean, you were sort of saying that, but
it does.
Because isn't Connecticut 25%? I could have it wrong, so like 25% or something like that.
Well, Connecticut actually only has to pay tax on their slots.
Right.
And you're right, it's in the 20s. Table games, that's what turned the whole Native American, so they didn't pay anything for the tables. They had those. But they did make a deal to have slot machines. They're not anywhere near the size of those. Don't get me wrong, Mohegan Sun is a nice property. They actually built a permanent. It's nice. They're adding a hotel. Sugar House built a temporary. It took them a long time to actually start working on the permanent. There's no hotel there. Even Pittsburgh is a nice casino property, but there's no hotel and some basic amenities, nice restaurants.
All of them will project, you know, phase one, phase two. And you got to give them time periods. Okay, well, you know, we put condition, you need to start phase two within 2 years, within 3 years, to get them to expand. And the problem with the Sugar House in Philadelphia was they were dragging their feet. But part of why they were dragging their feet, the partners were fighting each other and suing each other because the main group, Brush Street, wanted to expand a lot smaller than the Philadelphia contingent that owned it. They wanted more grandiose because they knew they were going to start competing against one of the newer casinos that were going to come in, possibly Wynn or somebody who's out there saying, I'm going to build this great resort. So they were suing each other, so that slowed everything down.
And then, again, just going back to that philosophy about dollars now, whether you're talking about a license fee or invest, versus we'll work with you and we'll make money because you'll have a bigger place, you'll hire more people, you'll pay more payroll tax and benefits. So there's a trade-off there, and then that's where the science, the art and the science come together.
One of the things we learned from Michigan was to put that time limit on temporary facilities. They authorized the Michigan temporary facilities, and they're still up and running today, 10, 12 years after, because there's been no push to get them to build a permanent facility. So we learned that from them, and then that's why we put it, okay, we'll let you build this temporary facility, but within 2 years you have to have up and running the permanent.
And do they have a high tax rate in Michigan as well?
I don't know what the...
I'm guessing, but it's 30. I'll verify that.
Anything else you want to add?
No, I just tried to lay out the parameters that we're working with.
You'll be developing a report on this.
Which you'll see in a couple of weeks, yes.
Yeah, and which will answer some of the questions that you
absolutely. And there's no right or wrong answer, but, we'll provide numbers, pros, cons, reasons, yes, reasons, no. So again, it comes down to what's best for New Hampshire, and really, what's the goals and objectives of the authority?
Right. Okay, easy to say, hard to do. All right, are we all set? I have set aside a little time to talk about planning ahead. Are we okay? Can we keep going for a little bit? Okay. I do have something here to... Yeah. While that's going around, I did arrange with the Director of Research and Problem Gaming to come here 2 weeks from now, talk with us from Massachusetts. He was hired this summer. Came from Ohio, where he had a similar responsibility, and he's the president of the National Problem Gambling Association of people who work in that area for regulators. He's going to come here 2 weeks from now and talk with us about the regulation of problem gambling, and with specific reference to his experiences and what he's trying to do now in his new responsibility. So that's coming up. But this document that I sent around is sort of take off from something that I think we looked at once before. Trying to look ahead, we've got a tight time frame, and we need to draw this to a close on December 15th. And in that time period, we have time for, if we just keep meeting every 2 weeks, three more meetings. No, four more meetings. Four more meetings. Did I count that right? One, two, three. Four more meetings with the possibility of having an extra meeting in December. I think what we're getting into now is feedback from the consultants. They're going to be working on reports. I've spent a fair amount of time working with both Jim and Maureen talking about how we're going to do this. They are obligated to prepare reports under the contract, with draft reports due in mid-October and finished reports due in mid-November. I've talked with them about how the larger interest we have as an authority is to produce our final report and our recommended legislation and address the regulatory issues as we must under the statute, so that our larger interest is not in the reports that they're going to be doing on an interim basis. It's that end product that really matters to us. And so I've asked that as they work on these reports, they work on them as building blocks for us to build off of for our final work product, and I'm hoping that that will work. Another way of putting it is that the drafting process is beginning with their working on their reports, and we could continue on off of that that starting point. We should get initial drafts of reports by our next meeting. Let's see, is that right? Yeah. By our next meeting, we'll have draft material. My intention is to circulate that when I get it. With the request that it be reviewed by each of you, and that we then come together at our next meeting and do our work on what's been developed to that point. As a group, there may be occasion for each of you to review the document, and you may be inspired to write a detailed critique. If you do that, send it to me, not to consultants. I'll handle it. But it may be better that we all come together and share our views and develop a way of moving forward that way. We can work through that. There will be decisions highlighted in these reports that need to be made, choices that need to be made around this, that, or the other thing. These, probably the most obvious choice that we're going to have to come to grips with fairly early on is regulatory structure. And we've been gathering information through these presentations. A piece of the first report that will come to us will go beyond Pennsylvania and Rhode Island to other states, so that we'll have quite a number of models to think about as we think about New Hampshire. And then at some point we're definitely going to have to make a choice, because that's going to relate to everything else we do on the structure of regulation that we're going to recommend for New Hampshire, that we think would be the best practice approach for New Hampshire. So I'm hoping that we can get to that decision point in, I've got it down here, November 7th. And then in the reports that come to us, there will be other identified choices. How far should we go on the regulation of problem gaming? How should we characterize that? Here are some choices. That's the way I see it, it working out. I hope that that will work. I welcome input on it. If there's anything else that would be helpful to the group, any entity that should be called in to give us input, I'd try to make that happen. But that's the way I see us proceeding. Yes, sir.
Just one question, Mr. Chair. Perhaps we could find time to invite one of the members of the state police gaming enforcement units themselves. I mean, we hear a lot about you know, what it is that they're doing, especially from Mr. McKay, from Ms. Williamson, but perhaps we can't go as far as Pennsylvania. That's quite a drive, but Rhode Island is just around the corner, and what Mr. Robin was sharing with us 2 weeks ago. If we found time to actually speak to one of the members of those gaming enforcement units to hear about you know, what they see and how those dynamics work, if we have time.
I imagine that could be arranged. Do you think that?
Yeah, we can arrange that. I can arrange it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we could probably fit that in next time if you'd like, or the following time. It doesn't have to be next time.
Okay. I think he works at the head of it, used to be there beforehand, and then they expanded.
In Rhode Island?
Yes. Yeah. The head hasn't changed in decades. So.
Yeah.
Okay. You can handle that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Good idea. Thank you. Otherwise, we're okay with this plan of proceeding. You start getting thick batches of, I was going to say paper, but maybe it would be, you know, that stuff that you get on a computer. Okay, we're all set then.